Good morning, and welcome to the November 10th edition of Mountain Money. This morning, we're going to begin by replaying an interview we previously recorded with Professor Katie Keith of Georgetown about the premium tax credit issue that's at the center of the shutdown fight. Then we'll be speaking with Jenna Summers of Deer Valley Lodging, and we'll finish our hour by speaking with Fernando and Dana Ramirez and a couple of special guests about Rancho Luna Lobos. A central issue in the ongoing congressional standoff that has resulted in a shutdown of the federal government involves tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. On the phone to help us understand how these credits work and the issues presented by the changes in the law associated with the Big Beautiful Bill is Professor Katie Keith of Georgetown. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some basics. How do the tax credits associated with the ACA work as a practical matter?
Yeah, so since the Affordable Care Act was put in place, there has always been some financial help for the monthly premiums that most people pay. These tax credits that you're mentioning are available on a sliding scale. So they're more generous for folks with less income and level off over time. Originally, these tax credits were available for folks whose income was just at the poverty level, up to about 400% of poverty level. So for an individual, that's, you know, about $16,000 a year to $62,000 a year. For a family of four, we're talking about folks making, you know, $32,000 to up to about $129,000 a year. So that was the law as originally conceived, and that was what was in place for many years. But in 2021, Congress expanded these premium tax credits, made them more generous for the folks who were already getting them, and eliminated what we used to call the subsidy cliff for those who are middle income. Mm-hmm. So I just mentioned this, but you know, those tax credits fell off at about 400% of poverty. This American Rescue Plan Act lifted that. And so folks above that income level under certain circumstances could qualify, and it really expanded, you know, eligibility and made premiums and health insurance under the Affordable Care Act a lot more affordable for many. I could get more into the details if it's helpful. Overall, what the law did was cap and mean that nobody should pay over 8.5% of their overall income towards premiums alone. And 8.5% is still pretty high for a lot of people, but that's essentially what the law did. And of course, that number's lower for folks who are lower income.
And when people hear the term tax credit, your instinct is to think it's going to be a reduction in the taxes I paid. But in fact, the way this works as a practical matter is it's a premium subsidy. It's actually from month to month, you pay an amount that reflects the fact that a number of dollars are being paid directly by the government to the insurance company. Have I got that right?
You nailed it. So it never even comes to you. It just means you pay less than you would have otherwise paid. And the insurance company is getting, you know, the proportion that the federal government's paying on your behalf. So it really reduces what you owe each month.
Okay. And we have the budget legislation of this year. How did things change?
So the budget legislation of this year didn't change this issue. I think it's most notable for failing to extend these enhanced premium tax credits that have now been in place for 5 years. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or HR1 as some people have called it, impose a lot of other restrictions on the coverage, but really didn't get at this issue, which is why about, you know, how much do people pay in their premiums, which is why it's been a huge feature of the government shutdown and sort of how we got where we are today. I think this is something that could have been addressed sooner this year and is not, which is often how Congress works, waiting until there's a crisis to need to address something.
Okay, so we've heard, you know, you hear a lot about this in the popular press at a somewhat high level. Can we try to understand, let's dig in a little bit and see if we can understand what that would mean for some examples of how these changes would affect individuals or families of four at different kinds of income levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So We can give a couple different incomes, and I would give the really strong caveat, of course, that these are averages. We are waiting to see how all this shakes out, but and folks who rely on this coverage should go and check their own information, right? But one example that I thought was very helpful, if you were a, you know, 55-year-old couple who makes, you know, $85,000 a year, so two people, $85,000 a year. In 2025, on average, that couple is paying $7,200 in premiums, which is not small, each year. It's about $600 a month. If and when these tax credits expire, this extra help that people have been getting for the past 5 years, if it expires, that same couple making $85,000 a year would pay $21,000 in premiums. So up from $7,200 to $21,000 in premiums next year. So jumping to, you know, close to getting to $2,000 a month, up from $600 a month. So huge triplication. Yeah. Like, that's an example of a couple or a family who was getting some help under the new law, the, you know, recent laws, and it would now be getting no help from the federal government. They would sort of be left completely to their own to pay for these premium increases. For folks at the lower end of the income spectrum, the increases aren't as dramatic, but I think they will still be quite significant for families. And an example was a 35-year-old couple who maybe makes $30,000 a year. They have not been contributing. They've been paying $0 towards their premiums, given how generous this is, but their premiums would jump to $1,000. And maybe that doesn't sound like a lot to some people, but if you're only making $30,000 a year, $1,000 towards your premiums when you weren't paying anything is a lot. And I think if you look at how much food and other expenses and utilities and all the other costs that families are grappling with, a lot of people just can't absorb these higher rates for 2026. And so the expectation is we will see a lot of people drop coverage altogether or go without. So we'll see more people be uninsured as a result of this. And you will see the people who stay in these markets will be the ones that have high healthcare needs, right? The people who haven't, you know, maybe have cancer or have a chronic condition or some kind of thing where they know they're going to need healthcare. So they're the ones willing to pay $21,000 in premiums or $1,000 in premiums. And what that's going to mean is, you know, the healthier people will fall out. The people who are maybe sicker than average will stay in. And then that's going to cause your premiums to increase more over time. So it kicks off kind of a bit of a vicious cycle there too, which I think is important.
Right. So let's go back to the 55-year-old couple. So it goes up to $21,000 a year, and that's just their premium. Do they have deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums?
All of that's on top. You're exactly right.
So therefore,
franchise premiums plus.
Yes. So if they are unhealthy and they stay with it, they're talking a whole bunch of money, and then the premiums go up, and then the deductible goes up, and now it's about 50% of their income.
That's exactly right. And again, right now, folks paying $7,200, that same couple, that's not small either. But the idea of absorbing so much more is just going to make it impossible. And so if they don't have healthcare needs, they're probably not going to be able to afford that. And so they'll drop the coverage, which is not, speaking for myself, what I want. I think people should have good, you know, high quality health insurance, so it's there when they need it. And I guess one other sort of macro point beyond these individual examples, and again, folks should, you know, assess what their own needs are. You know, these impacts are going to be felt the most in states where premiums are the highest or in communities where premiums are the highest. And so this will sort of disproportionately impact people who are older and people who live in rural areas, and then especially those who are above, who would now newly be under that subsidy clip. So those who are middle income, above 400% of poverty. And the reason is, you know, the way these tax credits work, the higher your premiums are, the more help you get. And as the help falls off, those are the exact type of consumers who are going to be forced to shoulder more of the burdens here. So again, rural farmers and ranchers, it's about a quarter of farmers nationwide rely on this coverage. It's a lot of small business owners. The impacts are going to be pretty broadly felt by a lot of parts of the community, but I would say it's especially going to be high in rural, middle income, older areas with older Americans too.
And let's go back. We went through some things that I think are pretty interesting, and we went through them pretty quickly. So is there any sort of projections about the number of people that, because of this increase, are likely to say, look, I just can't afford it, and are therefore likely to go out and go uninsured?
The estimates have pretty consistently been about 4 million people will go uninsured or won't have coverage because if these enhanced tax credits are not extended. And again, I think it's worth saying this has been the case for the past 5 years. Folks have really come to rely on this coverage. Mm-hmm. I am not enough of a data person. I'm a lawyer, not a data person, to know if that is a conservative estimate. And we would actually see much more significant implications, especially when you add on some of the other changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that were put in place. This could get sort of worse over time. And as we're watching the economic indicators, I'm personally quite concerned that you might actually have more people if folks get laid off or there's changes in the job market. Historically, you know, there's been a really soft landing place through the marketplace coverage for people to get insurance. And if, you know, the coverage there is not as strong, I think maybe we could lose even more people than that. But I guess that remains to be seen.
And again, that phenomenon that we've seen in the past or that is predicted of if the people who are most likely to drop out are the people who are younger and healthier. And again, why does that have an impact on premiums in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the ideal insurance market is, you know, healthy people and sick people is as big as possible. We want as many people there and so that you can help keep, you know, spread costs of the sicker people across everyone. And as you get into a system where if the coverage is too unaffordable, that the sort of younger and healthier people just can't afford it or say it's not worth it, and they fall out, you have a market that will just be spread across a smaller and sicker risk pool. And so the insurance companies will want to cover the costs of the care that they're, you know, offering. And so they will raise premiums. And so it can become this cycle. And then when premiums raise again, more
people drop out.
Healthier people fall out. It becomes this, you know, ongoing sort of spiral there. And so it's been something that I haven't made this point yet. You know, these enhanced tax credits, these laws put in place, they've been wildly successful at bringing more people in. So we've seen a doubling in the enrollment since these tax credits were offered, from 12 million to 24 million Americans right now relying on this coverage. And it is, the data shows, is a lot of these healthier, younger people who have come in. And I think that we've sort of known that for a long time. It's not that younger and healthier people don't want insurance. They do. They just need it to be affordable. And so this is these changes that are about to expire have enabled, I think, a lot of younger, healthier people to come in. And that's why you would see this kind of risk pool dynamic that you've highlighted is exactly would contribute very much to the, you know, increased number of people dropping out of the market. But it would also mean higher costs for those who remain. So those couples that we just talked about, you would see premiums grow even more.
Now so that's these 4 million people who will be dropping out. Now, are they dropping out on their own, or are they being pushed out because they don't meet the financial numbers?
That's a great question. I think the estimates are those are the people who would decide to go uninsured or simply couldn't because they couldn't afford it, because it would, you know, they would no longer be able to pay their portion of the premium as the premium tax credits shrink down.
And if these are younger, you know, 30-year-old healthy individuals, they must help the government keep the costs down right now. So therefore, anything that the government's giving, not only will the people be paying more in premiums, the government will have to pay more in premiums.
That's exactly right. The Congressional Budget Office recently did a new analysis that said if Congress extends these tax credits, it will cost money to the government, right? Because they are paying premiums, but it will actually show drops in the premiums overall, because of exactly what you said, and the would call it the risk pool implication. So premiums would go down by about 8% each year if these were permanently extended, because more healthy people would be coming into the market. And so, you know, I think there's some ideological opposition to extending these tax credits, but I think a lot of the indicators of more people covered, premiums go down. It does cost the federal government something to do that, but to your point, it also maybe costs not to do it in other ways too.
Now, we talked a little bit about that. You just mentioned the potential for premiums to go down. As we're setting this up, do we know yet the extent to which gross premiums. That is the amount that is the total cost of the policy before any tax credits. Is there any indication about how much that's going to go up, and how does that add to this picture?
Yeah, it's a great question. So premiums are rising in general. We have, so far, we have talked about the portion that consumers pay, which I would call the net premium, but the gross premium, you're exactly right, is rising. I think the last data I saw on this was on average nationwide. Of course, there'd be some variation. The gross premiums are rising about 18% this year, which is one of the biggest increases we have seen in about a decade, I think, since the Affordable Care Act might have been put in place. Part of that 18% is being driven by the loss of these, enhanced premium tax credits that are being thought about right now. But there's other factors too. And colleagues of mine at Georgetown have dug in deep in all the different rate filings and looked into, what are the insurance companies saying about the prices? And so there's factors like tariffs, for instance, sort of the overall cost of healthcare prices, prescription drug, things that are sort of normal and that we think about, and some that are unique to this time. I think the expiration of these enhanced premium tax credits was driving at least 4% of that premium increase across the board. So there, and so for people who, that number, this 18%, is hugely important for those who don't qualify for any of the financial help I am talking about. And especially for those at that, if we have this 400% of poverty cliff again, so if you were sitting at 415% of poverty, $65,000-$67,000, you would be on the hook for everything you were paying, everything the government was paying on your behalf before, and whatever portion of that 18% increase in your states too. So folks will just be paying a whole lot more costs.
And so when we did those numbers earlier, were those numbers, when we talked about the potential impact, were those numbers prior to taking into account the gross premium increase, or did they sort of include the net?
The one I gave for the 55-year-old couple making $85,000 a year did not. So that couple would pay an additional $3,700 if this 18% gross premium increase is factored in. So that's where you would see. So the total numbers, right, that's a family paying $7,200 now for this year, they could see be on the hook for $24,000 next year in total, jumping from about $600 a month to $2,000 a month. And again, if folks are sick, they might really have to scrounge together to figure out how to pay for that. But a lot of families making $85,000 a year are not going to be able to spend $25,000 on their health insurance premiums alone.
No one's crunching these numbers. I mean, no one takes into account $85,000, and let's say they're doing 25% to their housing. I forget what percentage is food. The numbers just don't add up.
Which is why, I think this seems to be the fight that Democrats in Congress have
chosen. Yeah, and
that's where we are.
And that leads us to our next question, which is the enhanced premium subsidies expire at the end of the year. Why is this fight happening now?
It's happening now in part because open enrollment, the annual time where people, come in and enroll for the next year, begins on November 1st. And, the normal process of things is the insurance companies are trying to finalize their premiums right the second. We have all these indicators, but if Congress were to come to an agreement here, I think those could be adjusted quickly and you could avert some of the crisis that we're talking about right now. But those have to be baked. Those have to be ready by November 1st so people can start to enroll. And frankly, if these are not getting extended, you want people to have as much time as possible to make these decisions and to really understand the implications. Also in the next few weeks, insurance companies and the state lease marketplaces are going to start sending notices to consumers about, here's what your premiums will look like. Here are the changes. And so as people get, this mailer in their inbox saying your premiums are going to increase by X percent, as we've been discussing, I think there's a huge concern that not that you couldn't add the premium tax, sort of add the money in at the end, but people reading that letter when you open it are just, I think the big concern is people are going to walk away. They're going to say, there's no way I can afford this. They won't come back to the marketplace. They won't get notified necessarily, even if Congress does take action by the end of the year to revert this. And so the concern is you're going to lose people between now and then when these notices go out, which I really think is why this is the fight that folks are having now. So trying to really avert those losses ahead of 2026. And sorry, I should declare to avert those coverage losses. The timing really does matter here. It's not one of those benefits that just kicks back up in January because people have to make decisions before then and need to know what they're working with and what their budget should be. People try, you know, families trying to do the right thing to plan out, you know, their finances for the next year really need to know this information as soon as possible.
On a slightly different topic, we've heard a lot in the press about the shutdown somehow being tied to a proposal to spend billions of dollars providing health care to undocumented individuals. Can you explain the facts on that issue?
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm glad you asked about it. So undocumented people are not eligible for Affordable Care Act coverage. They never have been, and that's never been an issue. Historically, the law has said lawful immigrants, some can be eligible. And so we're talking about refugees, asylees, people who have fled human trafficking, but everyone, green card holders, people who have a legal right to be here. So it's never been available for undocumented people, first of all. I will say, even what I just said about lawful immigrants, that was something that in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will be changing beginning in 2027. So Republicans in Congress closed that eligibility too. And so refugees, asylees, and other categories will no longer be eligible. So, but setting that aside, I think a lot of the discussion about undocumented immigrants comes from an effort by the Democrats to also push to reverse some of the Medicaid program changes that have been made. And there too, undocumented people are not eligible for Medicaid. I think they have been pointing to programs like requiring healthcare providers to, you know, treat anyone who comes in the door, that kind of thing, and claiming that is an effort to, you know, fund undocumented people's healthcare, that kind of thing. So it's, I would certainly, for all these programs we are talking about, undocumented people are not eligible.
Okay, we've been speaking with Katie Keith, professor at Georgetown University, about the premium subsidy issue associated with the Affordable Care Act. Thanks for explaining what is a fairly complicated issue to many of us.
I'm very glad you all asked, and thank you for having me.
Deer Valley is more than grooming, lift operations, and fabulous food. It also runs a substantial lodging operation. Here to tell us about what's new this year on the Deer Valley lodging front is Jenna Summers, homeowner acquisition manager for Deer Valley. Good morning, Jenna, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here in studio to share about our incredible lodging program.
So what is the scope of that Deer Valley lodging program?
I'm going to lead right off of your intro. You gave a great intro. I think most people, I might be biased, but most people know that Deer Valley is the preeminent ski resort in the country and that we have great grooming, ski conditions, fabulous food and beverage, but a lot of people don't know that we also operate a full service rental management, property management company, and we are going into our 16th year of this. We have been growing substantially. I've been in this role for 3 years, and in this time we have increased our inventory over 20%. We are now at close to 500 units. We also manage HOAs. We manage 14 different HOAs, and we have a presence in over 40 buildings, all the way from Empire Pass down to Snow Park. So we really aim with our property management to bring the Deer Valley difference that you see on the slopes to life in lodging. And we understand that a lot of first-time guests to Deer Valley aren't just being dropped off straight to the slopes. They actually begin their experience with Deer Valley when they call and start speaking with one of our vacation planners, book lodging, work with the guest services manager, ultimately check in and stay in a Deer Valley managed property. And so that Deer Valley difference has to be evident with our lodging program as well.
And does Deer Valley own any of those, or are those all homeowner-owned that you are managing?
We do not own any of the properties. These are all privately owned by owners who've come and entrusted Deer Valley with the caretaking of their properties.
And let's talk about the range of homes. Is this everything from one-bedroom condos in some of the buildings to multi-bedroom homes on the slopes?
Yes, we have an incredible range because we have to appeal to all of our guests, and we have everything from a ski and ski out studio, a one bedroom in Lower Deer Valley, to a five bedroom ski and ski out Deercrest property, Moonshadow, which is a new development up in Empire Pass. We are constantly adding new properties. I would say sometimes daily. So we keep the team busy onboarding new properties. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people just don't know the advantages of our program, and so they're still discovering it, and they're so excited when they hear that there is a property manager out there who is reaching this market and comforting the owners into feeling good about renting their property, knowing their property is going to be taken care of and they're going to be making some money too.
Yeah, they know that the Deer Valley difference is now in their property.
Exactly.
And exactly what is that difference?
We are always trying to qualify it, but at the end of the day, it just comes down to service and a standard of excellence that we're all trying to achieve. So yeah. We really need to, what Steve and Garrett's team does on the slopes, my boss Jeff and Sarah, they bring to life in our lodging.
Let's talk about the scope of that operation. I'm visualizing, with that many properties, your jobs include things like inboarding, outboarding, cleaning, maintenance. How many people are involved in this operation? And have I got basically the scope of what you do down?
Yes, you do. Good job. So with those 500 units, we have them broken out into about 10 different business units. And all of them have a GM, assistant GM, operations manager, housekeeping manager, maintenance manager, homeowner services manager, guest services manager. So all of these properties really operate in individual business units, which make it great. So our owners do have access to their GM, their housekeeping manager, the maintenance manager. Unlike a lot of our competitors, we do employ all of these teams year-round. So housekeeping is not a seasonal team going in. It's you have the same team for properties. They get to know what our owners want, what pillows here, what throw blanket is there. It's really kind of a curated experience. Our owners can have as much or as little involvement as they want, and they're totally dependent on our teams. We also do an enormous, being owned by Alterra Mountain Company, there's great advantages to that. So we do have a revenue management team that is constantly focusing on our pricing, occupancy levels, keeping an eye on the market, events in town that might be bringing up occupancy, lowering it, adjusting rates accordingly. I'm sure you know we have an incredible marketing team, so they're always looking at fun new packages, lodging new packages, getting the word out about available units, new units that we've added. They do great social media features on fun new properties. So it's really a cohesive team that takes the entire resort involved in making our lodging so great.
Great segue, entire resort. Rumor has it that there's a new set of slopes that might be opening this year.
Yeah, have you heard about that?
And does that create a new set of demands for lodging? And are you trying to line up, you're lining up properties over in East Deer Valley?
Yeah, so I mean, to be honest, this historical opening that we are on the eve of is probably one of the most exciting things I've ever been a part of. It gives us so much opportunities, and we are constantly exploring them and figuring out how to address with doubling our ski terrain. We anticipate we'll all be adding a lot of new guests as well. So we have been partnering with Sky Ridge, which is a beautiful resort community over on the Jordanelle. And we've been working with them for about a year and a half. They have a fabulous four-season resort community that is really appealing to what Deer Valley represents, the active outdoor lifestyle, as well as beautiful custom homes that I think is going to be very appealing with our guests as well. And honestly, we don't have a community like that in existing Deer Valley. So it really fits a need, and I think it will also be appealing to a new customer. I constantly hear from owners and guests who are just discovering Deer Valley still, thanks to our fabulous new airport, making it so easy for East Coasters to catch a direct flight into Salt Lake, be up here in 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I meet people all the time who've always been skiing in Colorado, and they're coming here and they're realizing how amazing, how easy it is. So we've added, in the last year and a half, we've added just over a dozen units over there. We've seen quite a demand this season. And we are really excited to continue to introduce guests to this area, help explain to them the location, the proximity. As new amenities open up in this area, with Sky Ridge opening their restaurant, their bar, their golf course. I'm not sure if you guys have had an opportunity to go over there. It is incredible. And just something different than what existing Deer Valley offers.
And as new buildings are built and new condo buildings are opened in East Deer Valley, I take it you'll be trying to locate some of those properties as well.
So we have met with pretty much every development over on that side of town. And we are taking things slow and steady because obviously we will be having to scale our team as well. And we go into everything wanting to hit the top notch. You know, we strive for excellence in everything. So we, working over there, we have had to learn a whole new county's regulations, healthcare, you know, their health inspections. So we had knew everything for Summit County, so this has been a learning process for our team. We've had to grow our team, the management team, operationally. We are really excited, and we are definitely continuing to look at new developments. We are hopeful to continue adding more. We know the demand will continue to grow, especially this season as our guests are skiing over there and seeing how beautiful it is.
Yeah, so let's pivot a little bit. Let's say someone is new to town and they're looking at buying a condo in, let's say, Snow Park. They want to just kind of jump in as a second home or investment property. If their HOA is not part of Deer Valley Lodging, can their individual unit join Deer Valley Lodging?
Yes. So that's where the majority of our properties probably are. We do manage a lot of the units in our HOA buildings and developments, but we also manage tons of them that are not in them. And it's really great. All of these properties from Silver Lake to Snow Park are part of what we call the Signature Collection. So it's a business unit of around 120 units that's based in the Deer Valley Plaza. And if you guys see the Range Rovers driving around town, the Wagoneers with Deer Valley on the side, these are actually driving around our owners and guests who are staying at these properties. I actually had a local real estate agent say, "Are you kidding me? You mean those Range Rovers are driving around just your guests and your owners? I thought they were VIP." And I said, "Well, at Deer Valley, guests and owners are VIP."
That's the Deer Valley
difference. That is the Deer Valley difference. So, and that's the way we treat them, and they have fabulous perks. We are constantly working to evolve our program, add new benefits for our owners, for our guests. We really want to make them feel like they're part of the home team, getting these exclusive perks.
So someone can just, one of our listeners can just say easily, "You know what? I'm going to get a place." And let's say the HOA is run by Deer Valley Lodging. Do they have to choose?
No.
Okay. They can
free
do
choice.
It themselves.
Yes.
But why not do it where you don't even need a car? So they could Uber up from the airport and then take Deer Valley
Yes.
cars around.
So there's really a big advantage working with a full service property management company. Number one, at the end of the day, it gives you peace of mind. So you don't have to be constantly worrying about what's happening in your unit. Is something going to break? What's the condition? Did the housekeeping staff you sent in do a good job? Are there crumbs on the floor? With our team, it's assign the contract and essentially come visit your property. It's in great condition and get a check in your bank account once a month.
Now, is your fee structure comparable to those of the other management companies in town?
So we do charge slightly higher, I would say, overall, but with that, you get honestly the best service, the best quality in the program, our housekeeping. I've never walked into any of our properties and felt like I'm walking into a rental. Every one of them, you walk in, they're clean, they're sparkling. The maintenance team does annual inspections. Housekeeping does a deep clean every year. So you walk in feeling like you're in a beautiful Deer Valley property that just happens to be available for rental as well. We have a staff on site 24/7. So if somebody's locked out, if something breaks in the middle of the night, guests just call a number and they have a team member there within 5 to 15 minutes, depending where they are. We do the marketing for the property. We take care of any, you know, happens rarely, but it is life. And there are sometimes kids spill hot chocolate. If that happens, our team takes care of it, makes sure it's cleaned. None of these costs are ever passed along to the owners. So at the end of the day, the owners really just sit back and see their unit performing, see it being taken care of well, and don't have to worry about it, the little things.
So if someone has a Deer Valley lodging property, do they get a free pass?
Well, not a free pass, but we do offer all of our owners 50% off the purchase of 2 season passes every season.
No kidding.
And that's fabulous. We also offer our owners discounts on ski rentals on the mountain, as well as with skibutlers.com. This past season, we unveiled our first ever owner first track days. So 2 times a season, we open the mountain up early for our owners, and I stand and hand out fresh baked cookies with our management team and welcome our owners. We are also doing a new program this year that I'm working on called Deer Valley Passport, which will be seasonal exclusive engagements, programs available only for our owners. So really fun kind of insider things for them to do and take part of, whether it be art strolls, tastings at distilleries, fun things that they can take part of. Also, as being part of Alterra Mountain Company, we are able to harness Alterra's enormous buying power, and we are unveiling a new program called Deer Valley Home, which will be passing along directly to our owners our steeply discounted purchasing power for home goods, small housewares, tabletop items, and furniture. This is super exciting. We've been working on this for over a year. We think it'll be useful for owners who are purchasing maybe an older Deer Valley property that want to upgrade and update it, as well as owners who are purchasing brand new. We have a handful of units in Founders Place, Sky Ridge. A lot of these properties are brand new, and they're having to outfit an entire home. And what better way to do that with discounted prices? So we really are constantly looking at ways to evolve and better the program to benefit our owners.
So whether you're an owner or a guest, you are getting
top-notch service, the Deer Valley difference, as you said. Our guests have access to daily housekeeping, daily hot tub maintenance. They have a guest services concierge. They can have holiday set up in the home, private chefs arranged. It's really a completely bespoke, curated experience for both owners and guests.
We've been speaking with Jenna Summers, the homeowner acquisition manager for Deer Valley. Jenna, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you guys again. We look forward to seeing you out on the slopes this season.
One might say that racing in the snow is just a part of life in Park City, except if you're driving your car. Slow down, be safe. Our next guest has done his share of racing in the snow and passed it down to his kids. That racing is dog sledding, and it's mainly used for therapy for the numerous dogs that they rescue at Rancho Luna Lobos. We are lucky to have their owner, Fernando Ramirez, his wife, Dana Ramirez, and a couple of kids, Hazel and Ariana. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having
us.
Good
morning. Thank you.
So Rancho Luna Lobos is a rescue kennel for dogs of Nordic breeds. Is that correct?
It is, yes.
And for our listeners' sakes, what are some of those breeds?
So 5 main breeds that we typically work with are, of course, the Siberian Huskies. Then you have an off branch of that, so Alaskan Huskies. Then you have the Alaskan Malamutes, and then we have what we call Eurohound, right? Mm-hmm. And then the last and final one we have are wolf hybrids. So we have a few wolf mixes.
Okay, I met a guy down in Camas who teaches martial arts, and he raises part wolves.
Oh, does he really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And he interviews the people who want to adopt them.
Yeah.
And just make sure they're adopting for a good reason.
Yeah, they're a special kind of breed. If you don't know what you're doing, you can definitely...
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to know what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah, they are wild, if you will. So now, the dogs that you adopt, that you rescue, they've had a bad previous life.
Yeah, we get them from all walks of life. We get a lot of surrenders, too. So we get dogs that come from excellent homes, then dogs that come from not so great homes.
Yeah.
So we really take our time to figure out every dog and what path they need to be on to live their best life. It can take years to work through some of that trauma. And sometimes we find that dog sledding is a really great therapy for them. It gives them a purpose. It gives them a drive and a passion. They like that camaraderie and being a part of a pack. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't like it, that's totally okay. we take our time to find them an excellent home. Unless they love being a ranch dog, they can be a ranch dog too. So, but no matter what it is, we just want everybody to live their best life. So that's what we focus on.
So therefore, every dog is not going to join a sled team.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, we have some that are dedicated couch potatoes.
Oh. Food testers. They're really good at their job.
That's my dog.
So what is there a percentage? Like, what percentage of the dogs that come in the door end up in front of a sled?
I'd say, roughly, I'd say about 90%.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty high.
Yeah.
90%. Wow.
Yeah, 90%. You just never know if the dogs. And the number one thing we can't teach is that drive and passion to want to pull. I can coach everything else, and the main thing is I don't want to necessarily, if a dog comes from a troubled background or he's too high strung or, you know, whatever the case may be, I don't want to change their personality. I just want to channel that energy into doing something productive.
Yeah.
So as long as I can do that, they make a fantastic sled dog.
And how do they typically come to you? What paths have they walked to get to you?
It just depends. We have some that a lot of people get this breed because they're so pretty and they think they're a lot of fun, but they're a lot of work. And they aren't expecting to have to really stick to a routine, really give them the exercise that they require. And so a lot of people just can't handle it and it's too much for their lifestyle. And so the Husky breed is becoming really intense in the shelters just because a lot of people can't handle it. So we get quite a few like that have been given up on. We have some people that will book their dogs for dog boarding and then they just don't come back. And that happens a lot because we're currently at capacity. So they'll call and they'll say, oh, well, I'm going to go on vacation. Maybe I'll just board. And then they never come back.
They never come back for their dog.
No, which is a major bummer.
I understand that in pawn shops, but this is really kind of different.
Yeah.
Wow. How often does that happen?
That happens often.
Yeah, at least a few times a year.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, when we go away, if we have to board our dog, we're just, you know, hey, can
you'll
we
come
pick,
back.
Can we pick her up at 1 a.m.? Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to get her right away. So how many years have you been running Rancho Luna Lobos?
We're going on our 16th year now. This is our 16th year running. We've been on the ranch for about 11 years.
Okay.
So that, yeah. We're going strong. We love it. And now with time with the racing, it's been an adventure for sure. Mm-hmm.
So in all those years, do you have a count of how many dogs you've rescued and helped live their best life?
I don't even know.
I would say over maybe 200 easy.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to do that.
We need to count. We need to go back and read that. Yeah.
So the sledding is therapy for the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through how that works. You know, a dog comes to you, and how do you figure out whether sledding would be good? Do you try them out?
Yeah, so there's a process to it. So we have, at our driveway, you'll notice when you first drive up, you'll notice a big yard.
Yep.
And that's called the Doggy Pueblo. And that's what we call our transition area. Mm-hmm. So any dog that's coming and that's new to the program, it's a neutral ground. We have retired sled dogs. We have some dog boarders there. Just a very neutral ground, very peaceful. And so the new dog will spend some time there. Once we've seen that either they've had confidence issues and that's been
addressed.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. Once those confidence issues have been addressed, then we can kind of flirt with the dog sledding aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So we put them in harness, hook them onto a confident buddy, see if it takes, and we give it a good, I'd say, 6 to 9 months of trial work. And if it doesn't work out, then comes the process of trying to find them a good family to rehome them to here in our wonderful community. Everyone seems to be so active here in Park City that it's really easy to place them in homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it is. Can one of you tell us the story of one of the most difficult dogs you can remember? And how you overcame some of the hurdles to get that dog either to be a couch potato and food tester or joining a sled team?
Yeah, so we had one that came from animal control. Her name was Zoe, and she was this giant Malamute, and she was incredible. When we first got her, she was so badly broken. She was very aggressive. And there's two very different kinds of aggression. There's dogs that want to attack you versus dogs that say, hey, you're going to hurt me and I got to protect myself. And Zoe was convinced that people were out to hurt her. So it took us about 2 weeks before we could even pet her.
Wow.
It took a long process. And then it took 5 really long years of being patient with her, working with her, putting her with different buddies, different areas of trust building and hikes and lots of different work to really build her up to see that not everything is bad in the world. And she finally got to a point after that 5 years that we could run her on team, and she was amazing. But what was amazing about Zoe is she actually became one of our best trainers. So we have a really firm no hands policy when it comes to discipline. We don't believe in using physical correction at all with our dogs. So we want them to be very affectionate. We encourage them to jump up on us and give us kisses. And that's kind of how we work with them. But if they're in trouble, we find that timeouts really work well. Or they just get to take a break from the team for a second. That will do a wonder for corrective behavior. But if we get an aggressive dog, our trainer will come in, which is a dog, not a human, and they'll help with that dog. They'll kind of set the pace. They'll have that energy level to kind of control the situation.
Neutralize it.
And Zoe was fantastic for that. She helped several dogs that were not rehomable get to the point where we could place them in a family. And now they're thriving. And so she was wonderful with that. But we just lost her a couple of years ago. She passed away from a rare blood disease. But
it was a very hard loss.
But
that was tough.
She did a lot of good. So it was amazing to see her transformation. Because her owners had said to put her down because she was so aggressive. And obviously she was being mistreated based off of her behavior. So that was why she was being aggressive. But
so people listening are thinking, wow, that dog sledding thing sounds like fun. Is there any way that they can try it?
We offer tours year round. So part of what we do is we want to promote a healthy and ethical touring industry. And so that's what we promote at our kennel. So we offer the dog sled tours in the winter, 2 time slots a day. We have roughly 4 sleds that'll go out at the same time. But our main priority is being so education-based. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we want people to understand what we do. We want people to understand the breed or the different types of breeds. We don't exist off of government assistance or any grants or anything like that. So we have to really promote our educational tours. In the summer, we have dry land tours that our guests can come and be a part of. But I think my biggest passion too is our kids' winter and summer camps. Mm-hmm. That is amazing. Yeah, because we'll pair up a dog with a kid. It helps both the dogs and the kids kind of come out of the shell, gain confidence on both ends. It's beautiful to see.
So describe for a second, if I signed up for one of these, let's do the summer first. Do the sleds have wheels?
Yeah, so we use a UTV, so it's motorized in the summers. That way the dogs aren't pulling any weight. They can run stress-free. They think they're strong. We tell them they're doing it, but we really do run the motor. But it's definitely a really fun adventure. That's one of my favorites.
Through the backcountry?
It climbs up our trails. You get to stand in the back of our UTV, and so it really gives a fun safari feel to it. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good time, but the main goal when you come would be to really hopefully inspire you.
In the winter, how long are the rides?
So your whole package would be roughly about 1.5 to 2 hours, and that includes a kennel tour, presentation, playtime with the dogs, and then the ride. The ride itself is probably about 45 minutes, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm.
Which, when it's cold, is plenty.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we used to do an hour, and people are like, this is too cold, so we shortened it. Yeah.
And so do you just take them up behind the ranch, up the mm-hmm. hills there?
Yeah, we have about a 6 kilometer trail system behind the ranch.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, when I stopped by to see you over the summer, you had a kids' camp going on.
We did.
And so what do the kids learn at that camp?
Essentially, team building activities is so we want to promote confidence. We want to inspire. We want kids to feel that they can apply themselves to something and, you know, achieve something. So, it also gives the kids the opportunity to put the screens away and kind of dive back into nature, right? Mm-hmm. Like, get dirty. And it's funny. There's some kids that'll get picked up from camp, and I'm thinking in the back of my head, or I'll whisper to Dana, I'm like, oh my gosh, these parents are going to be so mad. You know, they're dirty, they're smelly. But a lot of the parents come up like, thank you. You know, like, they're dirty, they're smelly, and that means they're, like, doing something. And so that makes us feel really good. And just self-esteem, because that's such a common issue right now. It probably always has been, but we want to do our part to really instill confidence in not only the dog pack, but the human pack as well.
Yeah, and we find that people underestimate just how much healing comes, not just for the dogs, but for people. When you have that interaction with the dogs, there's tremendous healing that happens for your soul. It's insane how much they teach you and it just completely changes your life. So that's the goal, is to kind of show kids and people that come out on tour, like, this is what life is really about, and that bond and relationship will change everything completely.
Yeah, so do kids come back year after, you know, summer after summer?
And then they work for us.
We started this years ago, like a decade ago, right? And now those kids are my counselors. They're in college, you know, and it's really wild.
Okay, so we are a business show, and therefore we got to get into some numbers. How many pounds of dog food do you go through each month?
Geez, if we're doing 4 weeks, 5 weeks, we'll go through 3,000 pounds of kibble. Now, that's just in the dry season, and that's just kibble. That's not including their meat.
Their meat, yeah.
Because they need about 1,000 pounds. I'd say about roughly 2,500 pounds a month in meat, which is insane. And then we have protein shakes for them as well.
Wow.
So they have to have their protein shakes in the morning. So when it's all said and done, right, they need roughly about 6 to 10,000 calories a day, depending on the dog.
And turn that into dollars. What's it cost to feed a dog a month?
A month, geez. Well, for the year, last year, we came out to about over $43,000.
For how many dogs? I'm doing metrics.
Yeah, for about 120 dogs.
So $4,000 in the neighborhood.
$43,000, yeah, right, yeah.
Exactly, holy cow. So besides rescuing these animals, you are racers.
We are, yeah, we race. I've raced my whole life. I actually grew up on Highland Drive. Yeah, I used to train around Round Valley before it was a trail system.
Nice.
And when I was a kid, I think I got the tail end of the mushing wave. That was in Summit County and Wasatch County. This was back in the late 80s, early 90s, right?
Yeah.
And so they had the Heber Classic. They had the races over at Strawberry, the one at Wasatch Mountain State Park, the one at Jordanelle. And so, and then they had a really famous one that I never had the opportunity to run. Went from the rail trail to Colville.
Oh.
And the next day they flipped it, Colville to Park City. And so now they don't have that, but
Are there any races locally?
Nothing anymore. Not even in the state.
Not in Utah.
I'm trying to bring something back, but it's been a challenge. We'll see.
I'm sure finding the space to do it.
Right.
But the rail trail would be fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
I think it's fully open now.
Is it really?
I don't know.
There's always construction on it out around Wanchope area.
Yeah, that's true.
So any races coming up this season?
Last season, we have an incredibly long circuit. It was over 7 weeks. We spent in Quebec, Canada.
Okay.
Dipped down to New Hampshire for the World Championships and went back up to Quebec. So that was too long. So this year, we're going to keep it short. We're going to run two races in West Yellowstone. They're Grand Prix races. And then we'll head up to Alaska. That's the plan for the Fur Rendezvous. That's a World Championship race. And then we'll come home and, I think, call it a season.
Okay, we just spent a few minutes with Fernando, Dana, Hazel, and Ariana, the Ramirez's of Rancho Luna Lobos. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.